From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in the voting booth. And of course, as we've been talking about this year, presidential election years always bring big turnout. But most of the media focuses on the presidential and the vice presidential races, and the governing happens locally. Now, the governing happens at every level, of course, but local races, state races are just as important as federal races when it comes to the impact on people's lives. And that's why we invite candidates for prominent offices to join us on Connections before the elections, with the goal of bringing the candidates together on the same programs when we can to discuss the issues at length with one another and with our listening audience. So we have a series of conversations with the candidates. We started that yesterday. We continue today. Republican State Senator Rich Funke is retiring from his state Senate seat, and there are two candidates to fill it, and I'll go ahead and welcome them now. Chris Mystic is a small business owner and a candidate for state Senate in the 55th. He's a Republican, among other designations, and he's on the line with us. Chris, thanks for making the time, and welcome back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Evan. I'm happy to be here.
And Sommer Brook is a candidate for state Senate in the 55th, a nonprofit and technology startup leader. She's a Democrat. Nice to have you back, Sommer. Thanks for making the time.
Hi, Evan. No problem. Excited to be here.
Well, here is a state Senate district that includes a wide range of geography. Victor, East Bloomfield, West Bloomfield, Richmond, Bristol, South Bristol, Cannadice, Naples, Rush, Mendon, Pittsford, Parenton, Penfield, East Rochester, Irondequoit, and the east side of the city of Rochester in Monroe County. So given what we just heard, I'd like to ask both of you to weigh in on if you think state leadership and if you think that you might have a role in providing leadership regarding what happens next in the city. Yesterday on this program, Jeremy Cooney, running for state Senate, said he does think that New York State Senate can provide a role in providing funding and support for everything from mental health services to police to building relationships locally. I'll start with Chris. I wonder if you see it that way, and I wonder if you can share your thoughts on what's happening in the city of Rochester first.
Well, first of all, thanks, Evan. I think that in any elected office, a diverse background, somebody who has experienced life in urban and rural communities, suburban communities, it's important. And it gives you perspective on what other people go through in their daily lives. Now, what's happening in Rochester is important. It's on the nightly news. People all over the country are talking about it and calling us. In a lot of ways, it breaks my heart. The death of Daniel Prude breaks my heart. The anger in the streets breaks my heart. The difficulty that some of our law enforcement officers are experiencing is breaking my heart as well. I think that this is a time for empathy. This is a time to do the work of democracy and for everybody to be listening, because we all have something to learn.
Samra, how do you see this issue?
You know, I want to go back, Evan, to even in your description of the 55th district, because it's funny. I sat here with this huge smile on my face, actually, listening to you list all of those towns, because I hear really all the towns that I grew up in. You know, these are the communities that raised me, that taught me the values that drive me every single day, things like compassion, humility, and service. And, you know, having been born and raised in the city of Rochester, I'm a proud Pittsford-Mendon graduate, go Vikings, and my grandparents have been down in Bloomfield for the past 80 or so years. And so you're right, you know, this district is interesting in that we have these urban, suburban, and rural communities. And I think that it's incredibly crucial that we look at the differences in those demographics and what those life experiences, but also having been someone who's walked in those shoes. You know, having lived in our city, suburban, and rural areas, I do have, I think, a more unique perspective of where people are with these issues. And in terms of what's happening in the city of Rochester, you know, I live here with my husband now. I grew up here, like I said. My mother was a teacher here. My own father came here from Ethiopia, fleeing a civil war, and found a network here in Rochester to support him. And so it's terribly sad. You know, what happened to Daniel Prude is wrong. And frankly, if our systems were functioning to serve people equally, Mr. Prude would be alive today. He'd be here with us. And we know, we see people are in pain. People are grieving. And it's been very moving to see how our community has come together from all corners. So you mentioned all of those towns. I will tell you, I saw our allies down from Bristol. I saw allies from Pittsford and Penfield and Parrington, and of course, allies in the city, all out there with me on the front lines at these protests and vigils, because we know that something is wrong in these systems. And the way our community has come together is absolutely astonishing and encouraging. And I think that we really need to ensure that we adjust how the police force is interacting with members of our community.
So let me just ask you briefly about that then, because we're going to talk about how police interact a little bit here. And I'm curious to know, I'll start with you, Summer, on this. Does New York State have a role in providing either funding, resources, et cetera, for more mental health support, any kind of support that might change the way police approach, or at least systems approach, these kinds of calls for distress?
Absolutely. You know, the state, if you look at the state funding for especially mental health services, right, we've seen that we have been declining in the funding that we're putting into those services. And I've heard stories. My own aunt is a registered nurse here in Rochester, and she is a psychiatric nurse. She is especially trained to de-escalate these kinds of issues, and she's been trained for it. Those are the kinds of people that we need on the front line. It comes down to what's in your toolbox when you're coming to answer some of these crises, right? We've seen the same thing when it comes to intimate partner violence and domestic violence. I've talked to a number of experts and people on the front lines in that issue in our area, and we've made changes to weigh who shows up and who's on the front line of those issues. I think we need to do the same thing around mental health, and I think that the state has an opportunity to step into that and make sure that the resources are there. But I also think that we have the obligation as any elected leader or any thought leader in our community to listen to what our community is saying. And they're saying that something is broken, and really uplifting those voices to make those calls for change.
Well, before I ask Chris the same question then, you're saying yes. Where's the money come from, and how much does it cost?
I think that there are a number of solutions we could put forward. I think it comes to allocating resources where we see the needs and making sure that those needs are met.
Does that mean moving money from other currently funded state initiatives?
Well, I think, you know, there's things that we can do on the state level. I mean, there's a proposal, I think, right now from City Council, right, where they've identified funding to go towards, you know, these kinds of mental health crises. And the truth is, the state does not control the RPT budget. We don't control
right.
The municipal city budget. But we do have choices to prioritize the kinds of health care that we want to fund. We have choices to say we're not going to cut 20% from much needed health care, including mental health. And that's what we can do. Our state has always made choices around the priorities in our budget. These are value statement documents, right? And I think that we continue to have those choices. And as more and more people are standing up and speaking out and showing us where the biggest problems lie, it's on us to prioritize those.
All right. Chris Misick, when it comes to the state's role, is there a role and are there resources to bear to assist with mental health and distress calls?
Yes, Evan. So even before we were made aware of this case, I had been talking about a lot of these issues. First and foremost, one of the things I called for months ago was the fact that in a police officer involved killing that doesn't involve self-defense, these cases should automatically go to a grand jury. The community should have a say. They should have not just, you know, an idea of what's going on from the mouth of some politician. They should be intimately involved. You know, it wasn't until, what, a week ago that the attorney general called for a grand jury investigation in this. We would have been several months down the line. Answers would have been had. That has to it has to take place, and it has to be coupled with additional mental health resources. We don't disagree there. We think that, you know, having trained personnel working with our law enforcement is going to be one step towards making sure this incident doesn't happen again. It's going to be better for our community, and it is going to cost money. But I don't think we need to raise taxes. You're right, Evan. The important thing is to get that answer. How is this going to get paid for, especially in light of the dire economic circumstances this state finds itself in? And to that question, I have two answers. The very first answer is we need to take a look at what's going on, you know, with regards to the pandemic and with regards to law enforcement funding. And we need to look at some issues, like look at the $500 million that goes to Hollywood tax credits. Why are we doing that? Why are we sending $42 million to Saturday Night Live? We should probably take a break from the $8 billion that's being allocated to failed economic development programs right now. Use that as a reserve. And put that towards issues that the people really care about right now. And the second part of all this is actually going back to basics and rebuilding our infrastructure so that we can rebuild our job base so that we can have less poverty. And I've outlined how to do that with my infrastructure bank proposal.
VoteMissick.com is Chris's website, SamraForSenate.com. Missick is M-I-S-S-I-C-K. Samra is S-A-M-R-A. Those are the websites, and you can check out more on these candidates' issues, and we'll take more questions and comments from the audience as we go later throughout the program. So we'll get back to some of what Chris is talking about in a moment. Let's kind of wrap up this section on what's happening in Rochester. If you're elected to the state Senate, Chris, you're going to have to build relationships and work with people in government and local government. You're going to have to work with mayors and supervisors. And there are calls, and there, as we heard right off the top of the hour, there's a protest where protesters are right now not letting anybody into City Hall, and they say they won't until the mayor resigns. Do you support calls for the mayor of Rochester's resignation, Chris?
So I will say this. I have examined the situation, and I find it in a circumstance like this, when leaders of the BLM movement and Mike Mazzeo agree on the same issue, they probably have something. You know, a fish rots from the head, Evan, and it seems like this situation has been hidden from the public and the people of Rochester. It has spiraled out of control. The leadership of our police department is no longer there, and the mayor's the only one left standing. I think that it probably is time for her to resign.
Summerbrook, do you agree?
I think that this decision has to be rooted in the calls that we've seen coming out of our community. Like I said, this is a community that is across race, it's across income. There are people from all over the city who are sitting today to call for these changes, and it's on us, because we are, you know, elected officials, public officials, to hold their trust. And when we've lost that public trust, then we have to think very critically around, can we actually do the job that we need to do? And because of that, I do think it's time that she step down and meet the call that folks have brought out. But I'll also just say, you know, to be very, very clear, this problem will not be solved with the removal of one person, but rather by continuing this conversation, by addressing the structural change that I'm glad that you brought up, Evan, around policing, around the way we fund and see policing, and around mental health support services. And quite frankly, this is a national issue. So we need to continue to address this issue, both on the local, state, and national level, if we actually want to see the change that we're seeking.
Talking to Summerbrook and Chris Missick, who are running for New York State Senate in the 55th District. Now, Summerbrook talked about mental health funding in the larger framework of health care. So let's talk a little bit about health care and what is possible or what is not possible on the state level. Samra, since you mentioned it, let's talk about what you'd like to see happen. Do you support single-payer health care in New York State, and would you vote for it?
I got to tell you, healthcare is one of the number one things that comes up, you know, talking across the district, whether you're talking to small business owners, whether you're talking to farmers, whether you're talking to single mothers. And the same story comes up, that there is an insecurity, a lack of information, a lack of support on both preventative medicine and also when someone actually gets sick. And I think if there were ever a time for us to really look at ourselves as a state and think about how we care for our people, it's in the middle of a public health crisis, right? We've seen what it means to have comorbidities. We've seen how your income level, even your zip code, predicts whether or not you will contract to the disease, whether you will die from the disease, whether you have access to health care. So yes, you know, that is an option. Single payer is an option that we can use to make sure that we don't have to deal with this issue for our next public health crisis.
Can it be paid for right now, given the state of finances in New York State and really all states in this pandemic?
I will go back to what our budgets say. And if we believe that we will not tolerate anyone else dying from COVID-19, if we believe that a farmer I talked to down in Richmond didn't deserve to lose his entire multi-generational farm because of exorbitant medical costs on his father when his father fell ill, if we believe that my grandparents at 80 and 85 who have worked their whole lives in Bloomfield, you know, deserve to not have to make a choice between paying a car payment and paying for prescription drugs, then yes, we have to make the choice that a priority is that people aren't going to lose their lives because they're splitting pills because they can't afford the medication that they need to live.
Chris Mystic, someone once told me never to assume anything, but I assume that you have a different view on single payer. Do you?
Yeah, I do, Evan, and I do because, you know, New York Health, a proposal that my opponent did support, has a price tag of $138 billion, Evan. That's $50 billion more than the budget right now. And we have 3% of the people in this state not covered by health care. So I've looked through this. I am someone who is an advocate for health care, too. And particularly in the midst of this pandemic, I've taken it extremely seriously. You know, one option that I'd like to explore, Evan, is this. We take a look at those 3% of the folks, and we take a look especially at the working poor who receive the earned income tax credit. What I would propose is we double that, and we open up a marketplace for these folks to make sure that they receive health care, that they aren't necessarily coming out of pocket, because there's nothing in those pockets, Evan. So let's help the people who aren't covered. You know what I don't want to see? I don't want to see hard-fought-for union contracts that provide great health care for those workers obliterated.
Summer, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I do. Thank you. And, you know, I will say, you know, I'm glad that we brought up a lot of the unions, and I'm proud to say that almost completely I stand with the unions in our area, and they all believe that I am the right choice to represent their needs in Albany, which is why they've all chosen to endorse me, whether it's the Public Employee Federation, whether it's CSEA, whether it's our UAW here, private and public. And it's because they, too, understand that we have a crisis. You know, we have a crisis where people are losing their lives because they don't have the care and the coverage that they need. And in fact, that is something that, you know, unions have been fighting for decades, is making sure that people have the benefits and care that they need. And so I think, you know, both being endorsed by the unions as well as our, you know, Rochester Chamber of Commerce here in the business community, we all know that there is a crisis here and that we can't afford not to act. The time is long past due to take this action. And that's why it does take working with unions, small businesses, farmers, employees, all of these people on the table to make sure that the solutions that we're putting forth actually will help all New Yorkers.
Now, Chris, if I could just kind of come back to you and I'll let you respond there. I don't hear you saying, Chris, that healthcare is perfect, but I do hear you saying, look, it's 3% uncovered here. And it's a very different sort of framework and mindset of approaching a problem than your opponent has. Do you think that the concern about healthcare and who's insured and who's not is overblown, Chris?
Absolutely not. Okay. First of all, I mean, CSEA opposes New York Health and single payer. It is not overblown. You know why? Because every single person in our district matters. And that's why I'm saying if we have 3% who don't have healthcare, my God, Evan, we've got to get it to them. And if they can't afford it, that shouldn't be the impediment. Health is important for all of us. I just think, you know, there are complex answers to simple problems. But when someone throws out simple answers to complex problems like New York Health does, it's not going to end well. And this is what people don't like about Albany. It's these promises and it's these packages that cannot be fulfilled and will not make the lives of New Yorkers, particularly those in the 55th, better. It's going to cost them, and they're not going to get the services they're promised.
Talking to Chris Mystic and Summer Brook, the two candidates for New York State Senate in the 55th District, and that's a district, a lot of geographic area. It's been served by Rich Funke, the Republican who is retiring. And we're going to mix in our questions with yours, and we've got a lot to work through. So let me just continue to work through some audience questions as we go. I'll start with Paul, who's calling from Brighton. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, hello. Nice to hear a nice civilized conversation. I appreciate that between the two candidates. This is kind of a prosaic question, and I apologize, but I'm just curious to hear both thoughts on the New York State job. New York State authorities and industrial development agencies and so on and so forth. Occasionally you'll see a report from Mr. DiNapoli about the waste and the, wasted resources, wasted money, outrageous pensions. You see stuff like, an upstate New York or downstate New York medical director making $500,000 a year. It seems like an over bloated system, and I just wonder if there are any thoughts on looking into some of these areas that might need some trimming. Thank you.
Paul, thank you. I'll start with Chris on this one, and I will say neither candidate is going to like this because politics, you know, is supposed to be rough and tumble. But just on the personal side, you're right. These are two of the nicest people I've met in politics. Chris and Samra are, and that's refreshing, I think. But they have very different views on the issues, for sure. That's why they're here. So, Chris, let's talk about what Paul's talking about. I'll start with you. Where do you see that?
Yeah, so, I mean, the biggest, most glaring issue of recent memory is the Buffalo Billion and New York taxpayers funneling so much money to a guy like Elon Musk, where promises of jobs aren't being fulfilled. You know, this is the issue that means our kids aren't getting PPE as they go back to school. This is the issue that resulted in the fact that, kids who have special needs, and I've dealt with early intervention and all of these sorts of issues, aren't getting the services that they need. You know, the corruption and the convictions that we see in Albany, it's rotten, Evan. And I've got a whole suite of reforms that I think will actually make New York a better place to live, to do business. I've long said it's not the cold climate, it's the business climate. And part of that, a key part of the solution to getting our budget back in line, is cutting out the fraud, the waste, and the corruption.
I have to say, Chris, I mean, I hear fraud, waste, and abuse often, and I've heard it for years as a journalist, and sometimes it's nebulous and sometimes it's meaningful. Can you be specific on where you're going to target if you're elected to the New York State Senate?
Exactly. So I'm going to start with a really small example. I'm going to start with the fact, and I didn't know this until I ran for office, that a politician running for state Senate raises a ton of money, and at one point, if they're no longer in office, or in a lot of cases, they get indicted and they've got a war chest, they can use funds raised for campaigns to pay their lawyers, to fight an indictment for corruption. It blows my mind, Evan. And they can hold these funds for life. Now, one of the very first things I'd be proposing is to say, if you're a candidate and you've got a war chest, you've got a time limit, 2 years, 3 years, heck, give them 4 years. But at the end of 4 years, that money needs to go to a nonprofit of their choice, certified 501c3, maybe an education program. And to get it passed, we probably have to find some compromise. So I'd probably say, okay, you can send it back to your state party. I'd prefer it goes back to the donors. But that's an example of where, you know, the corruption on an individual level isn't necessarily something that's breaking the law, but the law is allowing a corrupt spirit to exist. I'd also go for making sure that this state has a ballot initiative process. We talk so much about the upstate downstate divide, but the fact is, you know, I'm a common sense, even-handed guy, Evan, and I'm sure I'd love to sit down with a cup of coffee with Samra sometime because we probably get along really well. But the point is, there's a difference in what our two areas of the state need, and there are areas where Democrats and Republicans can come together. And if that's not an issue that we can get passed in Albany, the people should have a right to voice their concern with a ballot initiative process to tackle some of whether it's corruption or whether it's just a corrupt culture that may not be illegalities, but they're certainly not right for the people of this state.
All right.
That's two. I don't want to take the whole show.
That's a nice thing to say. But votemystic.com for more information on Chris's views on that. Samra for Senate.com is Samra Brooks' website. Samra, your thoughts on the phone call from Paul.
Yeah, we just covered a whole lot there, but I'll try to stay on topic for Paul's question especially. And you know what? I think that a lot of this comes down to a few simple things. And one of them is making sure that we even have a seat at the table. So all of these ideas, all of these different, you know, options that we have to reprioritize budget, none of that happens if we don't have a seat at the table. And so one of the things that you, if you may have noticed in the Rochester area, yes, we have received less per capita funding often than our neighbors to the west and our neighbors to the east in Buffalo and Syracuse. And one of the things that we really desperately need in this area is not just someone who is rooted in this community, but also someone who can sit in our majority conference, someone who is at the bargaining table, who gets to say, guess what? Here is what the Rochester region needs. Here's where you need to work with us and better understand what it looks like in our area post-COVID, what it looks like and how these policies are affecting us. That's something that I can't overstate, is really going to be crucial with the incredibly vital decisions and impactful decisions that our state legislator will be making come January 2021. And I think that the other thing we really need to think about, and again, I'm so proud to have earned endorsement from our business community here and from our unions, because there are ways that we move forward together. And part of that is how we're bringing economic development to our area. Study after study shows, right, that the types of things we should be investing in are things like green infrastructure, are things like new technologies, so that young people, both from our institutions here or who have gone away to college but want to come back home, so that they're incentivized to come here, right, to innovate, to be entrepreneurs here in Rochester, to build their companies, to work for our companies, and really to settle down with their families. And so none of that is possible if we don't have a seat at the table. And so that is what we really need to be focused on, that we send someone who is rooted in the needs of our people here in the 55th district, and frankly, someone who can actually go and get that work done. Because all of this, all of these are pipe dreams until you're at the bargaining table and you can actually bring something back for the city of Rochester and the region at large.
Summer Brook and Chris Misick, our guests, running for New York State Senate. They're on the ballot in November, and it's your chance to hear them together at length on the issues. Let's take our only break for the hour. We've got more of your phone calls. We're going to hit a lot of issues that you've been asking about: taxes, job creation, marijuana legalization. There's a lot more here. We'll get back to the pandemic as well with both of the candidates after our only break of the hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, expert in child health and education say the pandemic will have lasting effects on children's social and emotional needs and their overall well-being. We talk with experts from Rock the Future and the Children's Institute about how parents and teachers can help children navigate this unprecedented time. That's coming up Wednesday on Connections. And let's get back to our program now as we talk about what these two candidates for New York State Senate would do in office. And I think it's valuable to ask both of the candidates. Summer Brook, are you satisfied with what New York State has done regarding this pandemic? And are you satisfied just in terms of public health, but also in terms of the business community's opportunity to try to hang in there during these very trying times?
I think that we've done an incredible job compared to a number of other states, right? If you look at the number, I mean, let's be very clear, Evan, this is a public health crisis. So we need to judge it based on those measures, right? What a public health, how we've either helped or hurt our communities. And so if you look at it, yes, I mean, New York has done a pretty good job, especially when you look at other states, of making sure that this virus doesn't come back in a major way. And I hope that people will continue to take the measures that all of our public health officials have put forward in terms of wearing your mask and social distancing and washing your hands. And I hope that we can keep this curve low the way it has been. Now, having said that, have people been hurting? Absolutely. You know, we changed all of our voter outreach come March. From talking to voters, we turned them into wellness checks and talking to small business owners. And I know it has been an uphill battle for folks to keep going, to keep their lights open, to keep their doors open, to pay their rent. And so now is the time that we do need to continue making sure that we are supporting those people in our communities while always, always, always keeping in mind we are still in the middle of a global pandemic and we have to take these health precautions incredibly seriously.
Chris Misick, same question.
I've been personally impacted in my business, Evan. From the very beginning, I called on the federal government to support first responders by implementing hazard pay for them. You know, when I was deployed, I had combat pay, and it wasn't a lot, but it was a recognition that we were going the extra mile for our communities. Two, you know, I have a great deal of empathy for our nursing home victims and for the families of those victims. I think that we have needed to take this seriously. I have from the beginning. I donated 1,000 gallons of wine and distilled it to hand sanitizer. But that was a decision that clearly wasn't based in science or facts, because we knew from the beginning that comorbidities included seniors who had lots of issues. So that's my biggest criticism. Why aren't we doing more for our first responders? Why aren't we, why did we take that step with regard to nursing homes? And we need to continue to be proactive to safely open businesses. You know, we're looking at 14% unemployment. Lots of people are hurting. Lots of businesses are in terrible shape. And a business is not a car that you park in the garage and pull out after 30 days. There's a lot more to it than that. So, you know, I think it's a day-by-day thing. We consider all of the facts, all of the science, and we also consider a tax holiday for those businesses most impacted.
All right, let's get back to phone calls. Ed in East Rochester. Go ahead, Ed.
Hi, I'm a retired parole officer, and I have a question as to what your views are regarding reform of the parole system, in particular the community supervision aspect. And in addition, there's legislation pending called the More is Less legislation that was introduced by Senator Benjamin for parole reform, and I want to know what your opinions were on that.
Okay, let's start with Chris Misick. Go ahead, Chris.
I got to be honest, I'm not entirely sure what the More is Less legislation is about. It's something I'll be looking up immediately after this. I will say this, government's number one job is public safety. It's to keep the folks safe. And you know, anything with regards to public safety and parole, whether that be more monitoring, ankle bracelets, some restrictions, I'd be in support of.
What about the bail reform bills and frankly, the controversy that has wrapped up Albany quite a bit in the last year? Where would you have been on the bail reform package, Chris?
Quite honestly, it's one of the things that prompted me to run for office. One of many. Here's the thing, Evan. I believe reform is always necessary because we're human. We're not perfect, and we can always try and fix certain things. But to have taken away discretion from judges to hold somebody who had committed a heinous crime, I felt like it lacked common sense. Now, I say that coupled with one of my most important goals, which is strong families, keeping families together. There are clearly instances where an issue like bail reform, where somebody isn't kept in jail awaiting trial, is a good thing. But there are more than enough instances, and we've seen them in the news, where letting a violent perpetrator back into the community leads to more victimization. Discretion was the key there, and judges should have had that.
Sommerbrook, let's work backwards. We'll start with what Chris just said. I'll see if you agree with that, and then we'll talk a little bit more about what Ed was calling about. But do you agree with your opponent in this campaign on the issue of bail reform?
I do not agree with my opponent on this issue, Evan. And I think that, again, you know, a group of just to give some context quickly, a group of incoming legislators and current legislators met this past weekend to talk about what it means, you know, especially in the wake of all of the protests and vigils and all of these calls for justice, right? And to really examine and re-examine our systems, we felt it was necessary to meet and really actually go to a training for 4 hours, which I'll tell you is a major commitment in the middle of the last 50 or so days of a campaign. But we thought that it was important to really talk about looking through a lens of racial justice and social justice for all of our systems, because the truth is, when your policies and the decisions you make and the laws you put into place, when they have in mind the most vulnerable folks in our community and work for those folks, they work for everyone. And in fact, everyone can benefit. And so I say that to say one of the major things we discussed is always contextualizing the moment that we're in and always thinking through the systems that exist. The truth is, and I am personally aware of this because my husband works with court-involved young people, helping them not to recidivate and be caught in the court system, but rather helping them graduate school and go on to college or vocational training and getting jobs. And one of the things that is very well known and accepted is that our system punishes you for being poor as opposed to being guilty. By and large, the system itself as it exists. And so these are measures that people are putting forward just to make sure that we are treating people equally, regardless of their ability to pay. And that is what I think we need to not be focused on someone's ability to pay to get out right on bail, but rather whether or not they've actually convicted these crimes, because that is public safety. And when we include money in the scenario and your lack or ability to pay, that's not justice. That's essentially locking people up because they're poor and not locking up folks who can afford it. So I think that these are, again, very complex laws that we really do need to look at in terms of what it means to our communities, rather than looking at some of these archaic rules that have been in place that folks have not really examined. And so I think that's on the first thing. And then the second thing, you know, the Less is More Act, I do think, you know, includes necessary reforms around parole. And I think that, again, I always like to step back so that we're really understanding how broken a system is, right? And I think that let's just go back to square one. Whether it's me with, you know, my family members, whether it's someone with children, whether it's, you know, worried about your husband, your wife, whatever it is, we all want to feel safe in our communities. We all want to feel welcomed in our communities. The truth is, whether it's in the streets of Rochester, whether it's in the streets of Minneapolis, whether it's in the streets of so many cities and towns and villages across the U.S., what we see is that this system does not make everyone equally feel safe in their communities. Our systems are not equally protecting and serving all in our communities with regard to race and income zip code. And so when we think about that, we have to very seriously look at what works and what doesn't. And we have to be able to have the courage to have those hard conversations that will eventually lead to an equal and more just New York.
Let me get an email from a listener named Andy who wants to know if the candidates will support a super wealth tax of some kind. And Summer Brook, as I start with you, I'd like you to not only answer Andy's email, but I'll ask a pivot there. Your opponent in this race has said that the business community is overtaxed as it stands. Do you agree with that framing? And would you support a super wealth tax, as Andy is asking?
Well, what I can tell you is talking to a lot of our small and medium-sized businesses here in the 55th District, there is an incredible burden on them. And so we certainly can't afford to increase that burden on our small and medium-sized businesses. But that's not what this question is, right? This question is about the few super wealthy, you know, billionaires and multimillionaires in our state, most of whom don't live in the 55th district. Now, listen, I'm not a millionaire. My parents aren't millionaires, but we are working families, just like a lot of the folks in our district. And I think that a billionaire's tax could bring in much needed revenue to our state and actually lead to more equitable tax structure.
Do you think, Samra, that it would chase the wealthiest people out of this state, as the opponents of this tax have said?
Here's the thing, and I kind of love this question because it's not the super wealthy millionaires and billionaires who are fleeing our state. I actually had the chance to talk to a number of people who I thought were still living in the 55th district, but had said they had to leave because these were working families, just like those across the state, who had to leave because they couldn't make ends meet. They couldn't find the good paying jobs that they need. And so as much as we want to continue that talking point that that's what's going to happen, New York State still has nearly 120 billionaires. And, you know, they're not going to go anywhere because New York State has things that no other state has. And in fact, some of them are more than willing to put in their fair share to make sure that the state continues to thrive. Doesn't everybody want to come to a state and a county and a city where the schools are wonderful, where you can send your kids to public schools, where you have the art institutions that you want, where your infrastructure isn't crumbling, where it's bikeable, where you have mass transit that works? These are all things that, regardless of your income, you want. And I don't believe that that narrative is a true one, and in fact has been dismantled through studies.
Chris Misick, super wealth tax, and how do you feel about what your opponent just said? Go ahead.
You know, Evan, I know you've had Chris Arnotti on. I think there's this whole canon of books out there right now that address the struggles of the working class and the working poor right now. And I think that this is just sort of a red meat topic, to be honest with you, a political red meat topic. I don't know any billionaires personally, and I can only imagine that if you have that kind of money, you're probably just going to spend a couple more days at your Palm Beach retreat or in Connecticut. I don't think it'll make the difference. I don't think it'll close the loop, the gaps that we have right now. And it probably won't help very much, because the one thing that I've learned from reading is, you know, people with that sort of money are pretty good at moving it around or moving themselves around and keeping as much of it for themselves as possible. I'd encourage folks like Bloomberg to happily give more money to the state's coffers. I think that'd be a great move. And I think if there are all these billionaires willing to do that, they should step up to the plate. You know, I'm going to say this, like, I don't have any sort of philosophical issue with having them pay more, but I think it's a red herring. I don't think it's going to provide the relief that this state needs. That's why I've been such an advocate for empowerment zones in both urban and rural communities that focuses on coupling with the infrastructure bank to attract more jobs, to increase the tax base, and to help our families get ahead.
All right, let me get, let's see here. Where am I? Boy, oh boy, I have lost my place. There we go. John in Pittsford is next. Go ahead, John.
Hey. I think one of the really exciting things about this race in the 55th is that both candidates have engaged in national service. I was excited to see that Samra Brouk served in the Peace Corps and that Mr. Misick served in the Armed Forces. I think it's a great example for young people in our region, and I'd sort of like to ask about their views on national service, especially in light of recent news reports confirmed that the president has called veterans, for example, losers and suckers. And I'm concerned about a national environment where service is denigrated, and was hoping that Samra and Chris would respond to the president's statements.
Okay, John, thank you. Chris Misick, I'll start with you. Are you going to vote for this president?
You know what, Evan? So first and foremost, if the president said that, I think it's disgusting. Secondly, I think that the national mood right now, and there's so much divisiveness, I don't want to talk about national politics. There is more than enough ink spilled. There is more than enough consternation over it. I want to focus on the local issues. I think what the gentleman brought up about national services is great. And one of the areas that I've isolated in New York State that I think it would be fantastic to get more young people involved in would be this New York State Guard. Now, this isn't attached to the Department of Defense. It's not the New York National Guard. But as the pandemic was welling up in this state, it seemed to me that we had a huge missed opportunity with an entirely volunteer corps of trained folks that could have stepped into the breach in an even larger capacity if that force was bigger. So I would be an advocate for increasing funding to the state New York Guard. I would find ways to expand their reach to be able to help with issues, whether it's brought on by climate change with flooding, whether it is helping out in distressed communities. And I would ensure that everybody who was a member received free community college for their service.
All right, Samra Brouk, go ahead.
I noticed that Chris didn't mention or didn't answer the question, is he going to vote for Trump? So I do want to be very clear that I will not be voting for Donald Trump in November 2020 or through early voting or absentee voting. And I do think that, you know, this is an important question because this is a president who has essentially recreated the Republican Party from national level all the way down to our local Republican Party and redefined what it means to be a Republican. And for the kinds of things that he is saying, especially about people who have served our country, are incredibly despicable. And I don't support that. And I'm grateful for the people who have served this country in many, many capacities. And, you know, my service, I was incredibly proud to serve in the Peace Corps. I served time in rural Guatemala, working actually with local governments, helping them implement public health and health education programs for kids in school. And one of the things that I really learned through that service was the power of building trust and the power of listening to the needs of a community. I certainly didn't know everything that that rural Guatemalan community needed, the same way no one individual knows exactly what any district, country, village, or any jurisdiction needs. But instead, I was able to build trust across cultural lines, across language lines. There's dozens of indigenous languages spoken in Guatemala, and having to learn those and really build trust with these communities. And that is something that has driven me throughout this campaign, and quite frankly, throughout my life, is the willingness and excitement to serve people and the passion to actually listen, because the thing is, people often tell you what they need. Well, it is incumbent on us to reach out and listen.
I got
to
jump in because we're going to be out of time, but my goodness, I've got a whole stack of notes here. We've got more calls we could have taken. We probably could have done 2 to 3 hours with the candidates, and so I hate to do this to both of you. Will you come back before the election, Chris and Samra?
Absolutely. Okay. Look forward to it.
I want to tell you the websites. VoteMissick.com, M-I-S-S-I-C-K, Chris Missick's website. SamraForSenate.com, S-A-M-R-A, for Samra Brooke. The candidates running in the 55th District. Chris Missick, thanks for the time, and let's talk soon.
Thanks, Evan.
Samra Brooke, the same. I appreciate the time.
Thank you so much, Evan, for all you do. Take care.
We will have many conversations with the candidates before Election Day, and judging by the response from listeners, there is a big appetite for it. Grateful to the candidates for their generosity with the time. We're coming right back.